You're now listening to Sleep Time Sober.
Mr. Rick Blangiardi's debut to IG Live. Here we go.
Hey.
Welcome, sir. Welcome to Instagram. Welcome to technology.
Right off the bat, knowing that your audience is so familiar with this, true confessions, this is my first time doing this. So, very cool.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
This is great.
By the way, I heard your intro, and just because I'm a very sentimental guy, it just so happens July 8th, 2002 is my, I came back to Hawaii. Even though,
wow.
So 18 years ago today, I came back. But as I told the press when I returned, because I would come back every year, I said I moved to the mainland in 89, but I never left Hawaii. But thank you for the very nice introduction.
Well, sir, you have a longstanding history with this city, and a lot of people may not be familiar. They just see you as the man doing local connection.
You know,
so I wanted to get people insight
appreciate
on
that.
Who you are. And and I got to say right off the bat, you know, you're retired. You're a healthy guy, successful guy. Why you want to get into politics now?
You know, I didn't really look at this as politics. I mean, I'm not a politician. And I'm not building a political career. I looked at the issues. I mean, I had a great lens, if you will, between our newsroom and, quite honestly, my work in the community. And again, all pre-COVID, I made the decision a little bit before Christmas. And candidly, what I liked about it was a nonpartisan race and the job was going to open up. You know, it's Kirk was terming out. And I really felt we had a leadership crisis. If we looked at homelessness, very close to my heart, the work we had done, the rail was going to be a big, big issue. And we had major issues like infrastructure and elder care. And certainly neighborhood crime last fall was on the rise. And looking at all of that, and a lot of people, yeah, but you know this, I'm not going to be coy about it. We talked about stepping outside and taking on a broader leadership role. I really felt out of love of place that I would do that. And then we retired and made the decision, let them know, retired in January 15th, announced February 12th at the old stadium park.
Right.
And a month later, we get shut down in COVID. And here we are 2 weeks before primary, less than that. And actual date is August 8th, but the ballots will be out in less than 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And this is really about that, Aaron. This is about it's about my home. It's about a place that I've loved, and she's loved me back for a very long time. And I've been really involved with it in a lot of different ways. But to be honest with you, that involvement, no matter how extensive it was, and I had responsible positions, leadership roles, but the truth of the matter is I never had any real authority to make things happen. So there's an old saying, piece of business wisdom, that responsibility minus authority equals, you know, almost irresponsibility. So this was a chance to get into a decision-making place where I thought I could help. But since COVID now, everything has shifted, and we not only have those other issues to deal with,
yeah.
But rebuilding our lives and our home and the local economy now is definitely the dominant theme.
Right. Why run for mayor than governor? What was the decision to choose that?
Yeah, you know, this is a CEO job of the city. This is a high impact operations day to day. I'm comfortable in that realm. I mean, I've talked with other mayors in major cities and you know, they said, Rick, it's the best job and the worst job. Why is it the best job? The best job is because you can really make a difference. You can have impact. Why is it the worst job? Your phone rings on everything, you know? But that's who I am, and I'm not a legislative guy. With all due respect to that whole role and what office, I mean, I'm going to have to interact with obviously the city council and the legislature. But I love the dynamics of the city, and now really it's our whole island of Oahu. But it's especially under these circumstances,
yep.
The challenge of that is really day to day. It's much more fast paced in what I look forward to.
Getting back to COVID, I got to ask, as you're dealing with this, much like all of us, Mayor Caldwell and Governor Ige, how do you feel they did job-wise in handling that crisis?
You know, Aaron, I want to be candid on this tonight, but I really have made a practice of civility, if you will, in this. I did all those years doing football games, and Leahy and I used to always say, let's not try to second-guess the coaches on their play calling, right? The only thing I will say is I thought the communication out of the blocks – and maybe even up till now, could be better. You know, there seems to be conflicting messages. And for a while there in the beginning, people were making up rules seemingly by the day, and one rule was being overturned by another and so on. I thought, given the hardship we were feeling at the time, going back to the early days, the lockdown and all the uncertainty and quite honestly, all the fear, and I'm not saying people aren't fear-based right now, but all the fear, we're looking at scenes out of New York, and it was looking right. like a bad late-night movie. I mean, but it was right. real. So I think in moments like that, since I come out of the communication field, it's really important because it's not like we weren't involved. We were involved very much so in one crisis after another about, you know, giving out life-saving information or understanding how important the information was that it could save lives. But I felt that that communication then at that time could have been much better.
With, I guess, the as happening right now, we have this onslaught of the spike, as they say, in cases recently. I guess if we call this the second wave or we call this the first wave, what procedures or policies would you have in place for a second wave, second pandemic? What would your plan be there?
Well, you know, I think one of the good things right now is that we haven't had a lot of people die, okay?
Right.
A high percentage of people who have died had other related issues. And so I don't want to trivialize the, I believe, now 18 deaths at all. But in the time span we're talking about, that's not an out of the ordinary number. A lot of people have died from other things that we're not reporting on. For me personally, while I understand right now with the spike on the mainland and everything else and the concern and for safety for all of our hotel workers and for really, quite honestly, for all of us about keeping our borders closed, I'm really a strong proponent in trying to get other businesses going. Look, we had a lot of businesses here locally that were deemed essential that have done quite well,
right.
construction being one during this time. And so some of our smaller businesses, that's what I'm really concerned about. You saw, I think Sunday or everything's a blur, but the last day or two, they released the PPP money, the payroll protection plan money, and some 27,000 plus small businesses received aid, and then a couple of bigger grants. And so tonight I just saw a push alert before we get on here, and it talked about the fact that the $2.5 billion that Hawaii received in PPP is not enough. And so things are going to happen come the end of the month. People are going to stop receiving subsidies. There's a lot going on about with our hotels, even if, and I don't know where we are as of today, but if I had to bet, we're probably going to push back the reopening August 1. I don't think that's going to happen. So but we have other businesses here where, I mean, how am I supposed to, I don't want to be rambling here. I want to be answering, is this okay what I'm doing?
Talking? Oh yeah, you're fine.
Okay. All right.
I mean, considering,
I'm 60 seconds. I'm trying to give you a perspective. And some of the thoughts because, you know, like everybody, right now, candidly, I'm a retired business guy trying to become mayor. And nobody's bringing me into the table, giving me private intel. You know,
right.
I'm trying to get it where I can. When I was running Hawaii News Now, I had access to a lot of privileged information. I don't really get that right now. Okay.
I'm gonna ask you that later. But this is your forum, sir. I want you to expound on. Because you have forums that you're on for 60-second sound bites. And I don't think that is your style of communication. So this is why I'm having you on here.
All right. Well, thank you.
Away.
So I've been a strong proponent of saying that, you know, the whole notion of good public health and a stable economy are not mutually, they're not mutually opposite concepts. Okay. They're not mutually exclusive at all.
Yeah.
So, We have really, in the name of health, which is great, don't get me wrong, I don't be cavalier about protecting people, but we really have shuttered our local economy. And so I'm really surprised that we are where we are, and now they couldn't be pushing it further. I mean, the hotel business, we're 240,000 hotel workers. 60% of those hotel workers are considered to be housekeeping. There's a large percentage of those people that are going to lose it. And they're going to lose subsidy. I mean, this is really significant. And I saw a Senate bill this afternoon. They're going to try to mitigate, workforce development, try to mitigate people leaving here because there's no work and stuff. This is an incredible time. There's so many things happening.
Yeah.
So to your question, I think we need to get other people in businesses that may not be dependent upon tourism, those smaller businesses out and about. And we need to do everything we can to make sure they have access. to the monies they can get. I think the people are talking about this, but I've talked to a few small businesses of late and even bigger businesses. And, you know, there's a real added layer of cost now in the protocols of safety and what they got to do. You know, right.
Exactly.
You got to hire somebody to sanitize the equipment, everything.
Exactly.
So they've got that. So we've got to help them navigate through that and try to find whatever resources, federal monies. And then the other thing is, as we get more federal monies, and we're going to need more federal monies, help them navigate through that. So This, I think the role of mayor of the city is going to be very much in this helping and workforce development and job skill development and trying to a lot of that stuff. We're going to really be in that helping relationship.
Right. I mean, bottom line, I think August 1st is something that we need to push further down the line. Then I think it's too close.
I don't know. Anybody hear the number today? Because I don't know. It was 41 yesterday, and
It was 23 today.
23. Yeah. It was 25 the day before.
Right.
I think that's probably got them concerned. I mean, right now our hospitals. Look, the reason for the initial shutdown was to get our hospitals ready, and then it was supposed to open up again. You know, the whole big thing was, do we have enough ventilators, respirators, all that stuff? So we shut down, but we never opened up again. The hospitals were ready quickly. In fact, unfortunately, the hospitals had to lay off during this time. So our hospitals are not being taxed. I mean, there's this big fear factor, right? You know, and I understand it. I'm not an epidemiologist, and I want to yield to people in medical science, but there is something to be said for everything you've heard about the flu, et cetera, or for that matter, herd. You know, look, this is the first time in our lives, in our history. And for years, I've been a guy employing people and putting my employees first. And when somebody would come to work, it's sick. And tell them, go home. You know, I've even scolded people for trying to come to work, and even though I admired their effort because they were sick. This is the first time ever we've told healthy people to go home, you know, and what that means. And so at some point here, we're going to have to take that leap, okay?
Right.
And I'm not so sure. I mean, first of all, we all know that tourism is not going to come rushing back. It's going to take a while. It's going to be slow. We can watch that. But we got to get ourselves going as a people. I mean, we've got school year coming up. We've got a lot of things coming up.
Right.
I don't think we can stay in this sort of malaise in holding back on this. I mean, see local people are really good at wearing masks and social distancing. Everybody's trying to cooperate. I think people know that. We've got to have some faith in that. We've got to be able to use common sense and science and get ourselves back to work. This has been a long time. It's been a very long time. And candidly, I felt this way when we got to the second or third week of April, because we shut down sort of in the middle of March. We started hearing about it in February. I really thought that May 1, we were going to open up. And then when they said, no, we're going to push it back. Right then, I thought, wow, you know, we're really, you know, but we're not, we should be using more, because we weren't really having a spike here. And when you talk about a second wave, I admit that the 25, 41, 23.
That's pale in comparison to what's happening in the mainland, right?
Yeah. So it's not it's not like we're seeing. I think I saw something today in one of the push alerts, a couple 100,000 cases yesterday in the mainland, something crazy like that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
We're considered on a global basis, our incidence here is minuscule. But I will tell you the impact to our local economy, given the nature of our local economy and all the small businesses and whatever, we're like at ground zero here.
Exactly right. Well, you bring up small business. I want to go on a delve into that further. I have a question from an owner of a small business restaurant in downtown.
Okay.
And he asks, Chinatown and downtown have always had issues with homelessness and individuals who are mentally ill.
Right.
Union Mall and 4th Street Mall have become open air drug markets. Not uncommon to see individuals injecting drugs openly in broad daylight, along with the threat of random acts of violence being done to our community. How will you be able to clean up the open air drug markets as well as keep large populations of homeless from congregating in our city center?
Well, obviously what we've been doing hasn't worked. I've been pretty involved in that. And, you know, the whole subject of homelessness is a complicated one. And there are different levels of homelessness. And God knows we've even seen a very different wave of homelessness here if we don't get something figured out with rental subsidies or some pay subsidies or whatever. People don't have work, no money to pay, et cetera. Let's go back to the chronic homeless you're talking about and what's happened. So the whole notion of compassionate disruption has not worked. We know that. And if you talk with the police, and I've been out there, look, I've been in the doorways downtown, in Chinatown. I've done different things. I've had a real hands-on involvement, done a lot of work with IHS. I've seen that situation. We've produced award-winning documentaries and so on, trying to do everything we could to enlighten our public, to empower our politicians to make decisions, because if they felt like they had an enlightened public, they would. I don't even want to bring up the ACLU, because anyway, we need to have places to put those people. I was really involved in the H4 project with Queens Hospital in Eveleigh, and we've been able to get people off the streets there. We've got to get people. I believe I've talked about this before. I believe the sit line bears, they're constitutional, but you've got to be able to, 95% of those people that have been going to the hospital, the ER, and they're costing between $1,200 and $2,600 a day. That's an incredible drain. We need to get other facilities. We have to change our priority and make an investment in those places and resources and get them off the street. And you know, they keep telling me a chronic homeless number that seems a lot more scalable than what I really believe it to be true. And I don't really believe in the point in time count, which has got about 5,000 homeless people overall. And it's got this chronic homeless, you know, in the hundreds. But these are people who can't make a decision for themselves. And we have to provide, especially for something as sacred as downtown and Chinatown, you really think about it, what it means for our local residents. We need to put those people in places where they're going to get help and not just let it go the way it's going. So that's, you know, it's hard to talk about the kind of aggressive policy you'd like to see in wake of the fact that we're in this sort of free fall financially. Yeah. Yeah. But there's budget in there, and we're going to have to reprioritize where we spend that money. I said on opening day, you can tell a lot about what somebody values by where they write their checks, right? We have to take, I can tell you this, before COVID, since COVID, we've done research as a mayoral candidate, but I've done a lot of news research. Homelessness, despite the fact that in the aggregate, unless it represents a fraction of 1% of our state population, homelessness is still the big issue. And it is now because people are fearful. It went from people being compassionate and concerned, and they may very well be again, as we see normal families losing, to people now getting really annoyed and angry and angry and threatened. Right. And not the least of which, you talk to the police, these people are disease, filled with disease. We're worried about the coronavirus. And these police officers have turned into social health workers dealing with people that are really not in a good place. So we need to deal with that. Okay? So I feel very strongly about that.
And I got to ask you this, this comes to mind. With the issue of homelessness, it always comes up in any discussion or any political debate, for that matter. It's always going to be the main topic. So I ask you, in your opinion, what is the origin of the homelessness problem that's been getting worse, it seems like, every year? What do you think are the reasons that cause this downward spiral of it getting presumably worse every year? What do you see are the main aspects that...
Systemically, if you talk with the police, which I've been out on ride-alongs in different places, it's a lot of mental illness and no place to put mentally ill people, and really the remnants, if you will. And I hate to say it because it's still, but when I first came back, since we talked about coming back in 2002, I was no sooner back, and we started doing documentaries on the crystal meth problem, and the remnants of that. That's what I started to say. You got a lot of people whose brains have been fried. I mean, just, you know, and so we've had a big drug problem. You mentioned it in segue into this about people shooting up and doing different kinds of drugs out in the open or whatever. Yeah. It's, you know, it's that, but it's still scalable. If it's in the hundreds or even in the small thousands, if you stop and think about that, we can deal with that. We can deal with it. There's so much money being spent in conventional ways, it's not working. We'll bring it up again. Why do you think Queens Hospital lost $95 million in 1 year? And if you went to the emergency room, it looked like a war zone. You know, good people couldn't even get in there. It was all these people, $1,000 a day showers, ambulances, picking up, crazy stuff like that. The costs were up there. Got to have a whole different approach to it. I mean, it really is tough. Right. It's do what we can do. And look, I don't know if we're going to end homelessness. Here's the thing about why the point, a lot of people have been coming out of homeless. They've done a really good job at finding people who needed homes. But then just as people come out of it, other people have gone into it. But our chronic homeless has gotten where it's been, to your point about systemic, because these are very real issues, drug addiction, mental illness, and we've not tried to remedy it the proper way, which is you've got to put them someplace. Having a cop pick up somebody and dropping them off three blocks later, does nothing. Taking these people and then someplace and then arresting them on is a downward spiral to nowhere.
Yeah.
Okay. I was just over at Habilitat last week. Okay.
Yeah.
And I was really excited in Kaneohe. I don't know if you've ever been there. If anybody on this has ever listened to it, I mean, these are a bunch. We had 130 people. I think they have 155 beds. It's a 28-month program. All these younger people, and some were middle-aged, had all been drug addicts, had all been arrested numerous times, had been through different programs. And they're really, to see that and what they're doing, they're really rehabilitating them over there. They've had success story upon success story. This is possible. Okay. Some of these people may be gone forever, but we're going to give them resources, but there's a lot we could do. It starts with, candidly, when I talk about tough love, the irony is I treat them with dignity. They're people. That's the thing that's always bothered me. Is the lack of compassion for the humanity, and let's deal with it in a humane way. That's part of our culture here. And we'll spend money. We're already spending more money and not getting results than the kind of money we could spend to get results. And that's what's been crazy about it.
Right. No, you're exactly right. Exactly right. When it comes to the economy and homelessness and cost of living and homelessness and why people are moving away. I'll switch gears here to how would you be able to help families afford to live in Hawaii, period, from that or from moving away or from bringing the local people back to live here again? What would you think of that?
For the first time in our state's history, Hawaii Business did an article a couple of years ago and said that of the people who were born here but alive and living elsewhere, for our very first time, rivaled our in-state population. 1.4 in our last census. We'll see what the next one is. To 1.3. I always found that pretty profound. In fact, that's true in the case of two of my three children. All my kids were born here, two live on the mainland. And we've been the only state that had, over the last several years, despite a robust economy and low unemployment, we've had negative growth. We've had people leaving because of the cost of living, the loss of the value proposition. And now we stand to risk, so I alluded to the Senate bill, because University of Hawaii Economic Report said that we could lose 25,000 to 35,000 people next year because of no work, right? We've never had that kind of potential exodus. When we talk about chronic homeless, just before I start talking about affordable rentals, it's not about those people being able to afford. Those people only have $50 to their name.
Right.
We have been building units for people. And there's more going on. Look, there's some positive news about, but there's more we need to do in the urban core. We need to do it quicker rather than later. And we need to build to an AMI that's reflective of what people can pay. So let me give you this perspective. Because of our work in homelessness and because of the Alice Report, are you familiar with the Alice Report? You know, people living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
I was a strong advocate of minimum wage going to $15 an hour, pushing for it, not what was proposed in 2024, and even higher. I've rescinded that position. First of all, it's a state issue. But in knowing how shuttered our economy has been, and the fact is that not only do people live paycheck to paycheck, but a lot of small businesses, which is why things are so scary now, they run almost month to month. You know, I mean, they have no staying power. And it's just the way it is. Hardworking local people trying to keep families together, different businesses. And, we all know what that looks like. We all know what that feels like.
Exactly.
That's this place. Yeah. We're not a land of major corporations, we're in that's I've worked with a lot of small businesses over the years. So anyway, my point is, we need to build to a different, so people have a place they can at least afford to rent, and I believe if we can. Is all really rests with the DPP, which is a major priority of ours.
Right.
So we can bring together, there are developers in this town, smart guys with great plans. Stanford Cars One, Marshall Hung, there's a whole bunch of guys and there's city land. I mean, I don't want to start, but city lands are available, rezoning, expediting permitting, you know, looking at the opportunities here. We could build structures right now, urban core. We don't need the rail to come downtown. We could be building places where people can afford to live who are making $11 an hour. Some cases, right.
You mentioned DPP, and that's going to be my next question. Do you feel that DPP should be more efficient? Should more funding be involved? Yeah, more hiring?
His look, Sam, I'm the retired business guy. Everybody said one mayor after the other can't fix DPP. Well, first of all, the encouraging thing is they did an audit that was that they got presented. They did a big audit last year, 2019, and they got the audit on January 3rd. And if you read through the findings of the audit, it's pretty revealing, okay? And so that's why they did the audit. There's a really, it's a recipe. It's a how-to. It's a whatever you want to say, you know, on what has to be done. The place is you know, had a lot of turnover. There's even right now an interim director who I understand is a woman who's pretty good, but the way that they set it up, going back to 1998, has just made it more dysfunctional. We all know it can take long time to get permits.
Yeah.
It's added to the cost of things. So picking the DPP, first of all, the first thing we want to do is to see how much gets done when we look at once I get by the primary, we're going to shift gears about team we put together, planning, et cetera. But I've got to get by the primary. They asked me this thing the other day. It's going to be on TV. Well, who are you going to hire? Well, it's crazy right now. I've got to beat out 11 other people, you know, at least get into a position where I can have a reasonable
conversation, right?
So I would tell you, first and foremost, we're going to see and evaluate right off the bat, you know, what's been done in the DPP. But I can tell you right now, I'm a really big believer in leadership. And so we're going to probably put in somebody really strong there that really knows that business. Clearly, it is under-resourced. They don't have enough people. You know, DPP is charged with monitoring vacation rentals. And
amongst the many, right.
Illegal vacation
remodeling your house.
Illegal vacation rentals have run crazy. I mean, in 2019, most people don't know this, but in 2019, hotel occupancy was actually down. But our visitor count was up to almost 10.5 million, okay, because of illegal vacation rentals. That was the big spike, and it would continue to be that way. So, but anyway, strong leadership to improve morale. We're going to have to invest in technology and modernizing it. We're going to have to add more resources so they can do some of the jobs they're supposed to. And I know it sounds so hackneyed for people to say we're going to streamline it, but we've got to create an efficiency there. I can tell you developer after developer is seen as more than a deterrent. It's created additional costs because of time delays. Time is money. And I've been told by a lot of people, Rick, it's going to take some political will. And, you know, look, I don't want to scare anybody that might even be out there tonight. But honestly, if we've got something so broken, just not unlike homelessness, but this is within the door. Why don't we lean into the pain? Come on, you're a trainer. You know what that's all about. You've got, in order to get better, you've got to go at this stuff. So DPP and homelessness are really at the top of my list of things that we want to go about systemically improving. And this audit lends itself to that. I mean, it's really pretty clear what the dysfunction is. It's not like, oh my God, we don't know what to do to fix it. I mean, that's even on that basis, it's clear. But those are tough decisions. Tough decisions.
Right. DPP is something we've been dealing with for years on end. And
here's what I think. If there's a silver lining in this crap that we're going through right now, if there's a silver lining in it, it's that it should make things fertile for us to embrace new ideas and make changes where we need to that maybe we couldn't make in the last 10 or 20 or even 30 years because of what we're up against. We are up against some really tough stuff now. And it's gonna take that. Okay.
It's never happened before, and yes, this is the toughest. This is the biggest mayor's race in the history of me being alive. So this is
very tough. Guy, I can tell you, I'm a couple of years older than you. I got you up by 3 or 4 years.
A couple of weeks older.
This is critical times. Winston Churchill had a great line. Not that I'm all that prolific reader on Churchill, but there's some things I've always liked, and we're actually reading a book now, so it's top of mind. But he said, "You never want to waste a good crisis." Okay, this is. And I'm not trying to make light of what we're going through. What we're going
through. I understand what you're saying.
But this is a chance for leadership to step in and do some things.
Correct.
And to get buy-in. And if we can't create buy-in for the greater good, for the good of our people, given what we're up against, then shame on anybody in that office.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Shifting gears, got a lot of stuff coming in question-wise, but I want to switch over to the rail. I know you have a lot to say on that. Where should the last stop be? Where are we going? Middle Street, Ala Moana, what are we doing?
Well, I think it's really a matter of affordability. Let me give you a couple of perspectives about the rail, because I had a pre-COVID and post-COVID thing. I always looked at rail. Rail initially, we all, you know, when it got voted barely on by 51% on a project for $4 billion at the time, was a 100-year project to really kind of link together, if you will, downtown Honolulu with the development of a second city, West Oahu. 100-year project, which is part of why they decided to go with the gold standard and build this incredible heavy rail system against all whatever, because it was going to be that, okay? So my understanding right now, first of all, we're gonna have hundreds of thousands of people out of work. So let me just say this as a concept. You've got a project right now that they built the easy part first, and it's already more than 2.5 times over its original budget.
Yeah. Okay,
that was the easy part. The hard part, the city center segment of 4.1 miles, which is really a bridge, which is budgeted at $1.4 billion, and we're waiting for a P3, because we're supposed to have done this in the beginning of all this stuff, to step in and say they'll do that in return for 30 years of operating and transit-oriented development, okay, around the rail station, some in the urban core. It's a kind of a complex deal. Nobody really knows all the terms, nobody. But based on what I do know, that we're supposed to believe that the hard part, which they saved to last, is going to come in and budget on time. Here you are, 2.5 times over budget, 8 years delayed. Feds have retained or held back their $750 million because it's been under criminal investigation for fraud and corruption. So the likelihood of getting more federal monies, I don't know. What's the feasibility of that? I mean, so I would say with hundreds of thousands of people out of work, no tourists, keep in mind a big driver in this operating was going to be TAT, okay, hotel room tax, and the general excise tax from sales tax, which they've already said it was already released over $100 million shortfall, expected to be possibly $200 million, especially with delays. So now you don't have that money. You don't have tourists doing that. You've got unknown costs. You've got the really hard part of the project coming up. And you've got hundreds of thousands of people possibly out of work. Okay. Yeah. All right. So I would say, as a business guy, irrespective of, is that I don't think that's feasible. I don't think that's feasible. I think, I've held off as opposed to a stake in the ground and saying we're going to stop that. I want to see the P3 and be prudent and see what we can learn from that and what gets exposed. But I would tell you that I would not hesitate to say we stop at Middle Street. In fact, nobody stopped it. We could actually move it up and have it. People could start to ride it from Middle Street more years in advance, right? Number one. Number two, think about Middle Street. Go out there. Look at the hub. Look at the area. We could develop a really smart express bus system. I like what the bus is right now to take people where they want to go. Waikiki, downtown Honolulu, even the university from there in a place where you have a lot more room to do anything like I know it's on some drawing plans, which I've not seen, to build a hub at Ala Moana Center. I still don't know what that's going to look like and what it would be.
Right.
Even then, it becomes a multimodal bus plus handy van kind of thing. So
we're looking at Middle Street, and then we bus them out from there.
Well, I think everybody was. This is not the real discussion of 2012. This is not Caldwell versus Cayetano. This is 2020 in a very different dynamic. And we're in a pandemic that's crippled us financially.
Right.
And we've got all these uncertain costs. So, you know, if we have to rethink, we just wouldn't be the first people rethinking a civil works project and rethink and re-engineer and reinvent a concept that maybe before everybody said, oh, if you stop in Middle Street, it's a white elephant. But if you could develop an express system there in buses and really move it, if you stop and think about, and you could do it years in advance and for less money, And maybe even a better service than what it would have been to provide. I mean, those are possibilities. You can't take these rails down to grade level. These cars won't do that. They're only meant to ride on that system. I think we paid like $400,000 for them, $400 million, I'm sorry, or close to $500 million. So, you know, so I don't think the notion of stopping at Middle Street creates the white elephant. I think we have to reinvent as everything and re-engineer as a possibility because you can't afford it. Aaron, right. I don't want to make this too personal, and I see you living on your own right there, but if you and your wife were going to remodel or do something out, and somehow something happened to you financially and you couldn't do it, you would rethink it.
Sell the house. Yeah.
You would. Anybody on this call would. I mean,
anybody watching this is going to say the same thing. Yes.
I want to be practical here. Under this
financial situation. Yeah.
Okay. I would tell you the people whispering in your ears, people telling me you're talking in numbers of $13, $14 billion. That's up $2, $3, $4 billion more to come down and build a bridge through. And any other thing that somebody mentioned to me the other day, since Elmwood Boulevard has been developed with these high-rise condominiums, what wasn't factored in when they did the initial geological stuff is when they start putting that stuff in there, when they were to come down Elmwood Boulevard, the foundations, because of the things how that what that could possibly even do to some of the buildings that are there.
Yeah.
Okay. And I mean, there's a lot of things you could run into beyond just talking about the EV and all the other things.
Of course.
The Dillingham corridor. Okay.
Right.
Elmwood Boulevard might even be more treacherous. So I just think it's huge prudent. And again, it's not the 2012 conversation. This is 2020 in the midst of a broken economy.
Right.
So that's where I am.
I love it when you get like this.
Well, I just want to be realistic.
This is great.
I just want to be realistic. I mean,
I know you are. Yes, I love it.
Let's build it to Hawaii Kai. Let's go to the university. I mean, what are you, nuts? I mean, who's going to pay for that?
That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen.
I'm running against people right now who are saying, let's do it at all costs. We need to do it at all costs. I'm not going to knock any of them. Tell me how you're going to do that.
Yeah.
How are you going to do that?
Right. Okay. Well, it's common sense. Not financially, it's not there. It's a common sense, logical situation, which not so common is common sense.
You don't have tourism money. Now, here's the thing. I said this very clear, and I heard yesterday a couple of the candidates said the same, but if you watched that show yesterday, he said, or listened to it or whatever, I'm not going to raise property taxes. You have to be able to say that with confidence, because how could you possibly raise property taxes to our people right now, given the dynamics in play, where we're facing potential unprecedented numbers of bankruptcies and whatever else.
You can't
look at that as a source of revenue, which is where the city gets its money, okay?
Yes, well, another viewer question for you.
Go ahead.
Okay, here we go.
How are we doing so far? Do I get like a mid-show review here? Is this what you wanted, or should I tune it back?
We're 40 minutes in. I have to say, you're holding, the passion is there. That's what I was getting at. I wanted you to get and come through with that and portray
this
it.
I live here like everybody else on this thing. We love this place. It is not easy to live here anymore.
Okay? No.
Part of being a mayor is to be a steward for the people of how we spend money. Let's just break it down to common sense. How we spend money and how we take care of our people. You know, society is judged, and I strongly believe this, by how we take care of our most vulnerable. That's how a society is judged. And right now, given the impact, we've all become vulnerable, all of us. So how do you respond in that situation from a leadership standpoint?
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. That's the question that they're going to have to answer, especially this year, especially August 8th.
You make bold ideas, you make things happen. And
right.
And let me just say this. Nobody has a plan. I got knocked a little bit today in this article that Hawaii News Now did about the lack of specific plans. I'm not going to hand some plan and say, here's the way, the truth, and the light right now, 5.5 months before we get into office. When I think back about how much has happened even in the last 4 months since we've shut down, I can't even predict that far to sit there and say, here's what we're going to do. I want to be in the know, I want to be in the now, and I want to be smart about it. It's not a time for campaign promises or statements that can't be lived up to.
That's a very true, honest answer. Yes. That's what people always expect, a specific answer. Which cannot be done in this time.
This is not a time for some policy.
It can't be done.
This is not a time for some policy wonk to go into office, okay? This is about leadership. This is about raw leadership, tough decision making, surrounding yourself with really good people. One of the things I say in this thing, I have no notions at all. This is all about me. I'm not running to be the Wizard of Oz here. It's a big responsibility, but there's going to be a lot of men and women in this city to help do the job. That's how it's going to get done.
I like it. I like it, sir. Let's go on to something a little lighthearted. Let's go to police reform. So, I got a viewer question on this one. It's an interesting one, sir, so hang in there with me on this. Will police be used to intimidate and arrest Hawaiians peacefully protesting the further desecration of their lands through corporate greenwash projects like the EES Kahuku Wind Farm, which never went through the proper environmental assessments and was pushed through despite very strong and vocal resistance from the Kahuku community? What will you do to address these conflicts where large corporations can drown out community voices and push development projects through in communities that do not want them?
Well, first of all, I don't know if I blame the police for Kahuku. The police were brought in to reinforce the situation, and what got done there, you know, should have been more community-based, okay? And I mean, I was still working in Hawaii News Now when we were doing that. And, you know, I wasn't in any of those meetings, but I can tell you this. I signed, I don't know what, if the others before call, I signed the pledge to protect Sherwood Forest. I went out there. My kids grew up in Bellows as kids, but I knew Waimanalo. I went out there and literally walked the grounds, walked all over, drove all over the back of Waimanalo. And saw how big and saw the other fields and what we could do. And I did. And then, you know, and then not too long ago, you know, Caldwell threw in the towel on doing that.
Yeah.
But it was already almost too late for Kahuku. But I'm going to use the Sherwood Forest thing to say, as a leader, we need to be more community-based. I had a great talk the other night with a number of people at Zoom call on the North Shore. I'm kind of old school. Okay. I've lived here, as you said in the opening, since 1965. I want to preserve and protect Whitney. I want to sell out to developers. Besides that, we've got a lot of challenges right now on how we're going to even keep people here. So I do believe that wind is a big component of our energy. All right. I don't know what went on and what was said and whatever, but people felt like they got deceived. The turbines were too close to whatever. I don't have anything to do with that. I would promise anybody going in on any environment, because energy is going to be a big part. And we start talking about not diversified economy, but entrepreneurial ideas and sectors we can build in. Construction is one. Energy is a big one. And same with that, right? So, but we can't be doing that to communities, especially. Look, I was out in Waianae the other day, and most of what I listened to was really state-run things, but I wanted to listen to those people. And so my takeaway, we had a great meeting in the beach and the sand. Even Buffalo Kalana came to it. I was so honored. It was with all the seniors up there. It was just having a voice. I mean, that's what I was listening to. They wanted to have somebody who would listen to them, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to say placate. I think that going forward as we rebuild, Aaron, this is going to take years. Okay. So I'm going to tell you right now, I've been a guy my whole career. And I want to stay on this question, was hired to replace somebody who got fired. And I was that turnaround guy. And that's true of my last body of work, the broken economy of 2008. We created a 21st century multimedia company in Hawaii News Now. And I would tell you this, I really want to be very community-based and make people look. I'm not building a political career. I'm not going to get compromised. Okay. And I'm not saying I made the most of money in the world, but I retired. I worked really hard. I'm not going to get bought either. I'm just going to say that out loud. I'm not implying anybody else has gotten compromised or bought. I just know the integrity that I'll bring to the job. And I think we have to pay real close attention to our communities, particularly the rurals, who always get the ass end of it, if I can say that. You know what I mean? I know that they feel that way out in Waianae and Nanakuli. It's like, it's like, you know, nobody cares about us and so on and so forth,
right.
Even in Kahuku. So I want to stay sensitive to that. And I think that has to be part of our healing going forward, because it's not easy to live here. And for all the people, I'm going to be on the public radio this weekend, Sunday, talking the same thing. I want to stay sensitive to that group of people. I really do. I honestly, God, even though I know I sound like I fell off a food truck in the Bronx. By the way, I was born in Cambridge, not in Boston, but that's okay. They're close to each other.
It's on your site.
My heart. Well, it's on my site. Who knows? I can't even do a website.
Correct that.
Right. I got to check that out.
Get on it.
Yeah. But my heart has always been, I've always felt like it was just an incredible blessing that I got to live my life here. For a guy who grew up so far away, grew up in a very different. So I think in this
will be my final chapter, if you will. I want to do right by this place. I said this earlier, you know, I've loved Hawaii since I first met her, and she's loved me in return. So I want to be smart about that stuff. Yeah. And so that's the best I can promise.
Right. Well, bringing up history, and I want you to clear the air on this one.
Go ahead. Because
it recently developed, and I know you know where I'm headed with this, 35 years ago.
37.
37?
1983 is when the incident.
Therefore, you know what I'm talking about. The federal government sued you for participation in a loan scam, which resurfaced.
The federal government did what?
They sued you for your participation in a loan scam. Talk about that. I want you to clear the air on this.
Okay, let's be clear. The FDIC, all right? So here's the deal. In 1983, okay, we had a guy named Sam Daly who was an advertiser, big advertiser, who was a retired Air Force colonel. And he was a big real estate developer, especially on the Windward side. And he came to myself and two of the guys I work with because he was advertising. I said, I've got a great deal for young men. You know, this is great. And we're building homes on the Windward side of Oahu. They brought this guy from out of town, from Indian Springs State Bank, a guy named Bill LeMaster, who looked like right out of Central Casting for a bank president. You know, looked like anybody in this call would remember Charles Marsden, white hair, very debonair looking guy. We sit down with these guys and they say, sign this promissory note and this is how we do it. And so the long and the short of it is, we bought that, we did that. These guys turned out to be scam artists, so I ended up taking full responsibility for my mistake. They all went to jail. I was a key witness for the FBI putting them in jail once we realized we got scammed. But in those days, the FDIC, because we signed promissory notes, even though there was a criminal action on those guys, was still going to hold us liable for that money. So I paid dearly for that because I couldn't afford to pay that to a personal bank. But bottom line is, I trusted the wrong guys. I made a mistake. I paid for it. I learned from my lessons. They went to jail, and I rebuilt my life. That was 37 years ago. And honestly, you can't even Google that. Somebody did what they told me at this term, opposition research. Here's what I'll tell you. And this is, you can check it out. I've had a lot of important jobs in my career, and I've been involved in the FCC, and I've also been on bank boards, and I've been vetted by the FDIC. But if you hold in the roles that I've had for the FCC, or even for that matter, when I worked at CBS in New York, even in the early 90s, when I went to work at the network, they were doing drug testing in those years. I have been vetted deeply, time and again. This has never come up before, okay? So this is somebody who doesn't like the fact that I'm ahead in the polls, okay, who wants to discredit me. So the best thing I'll tell you is that was painful. I learned, take full responsibility. It was 37 years ago. And that's the worst thing they're going to find on me 37 years ago, okay? And my life has been an open book as I've lived here. You know me, Aaron. I'm out there. I've been out there for a long time. So that was hurtful last week. It was the first time in my life that I had been embarrassed like that. It's something where I also felt at the same time somebody was hurting, trying out to hurt me. It was pretty unsettling. I made a comment in the Star Advertiser. I don't know if you saw the article. I said, this is the very reason why people from the private sector never want to go into politics. It really creates a leadership void because of crap like that. Okay? That's it.
Wow. No idea who that was, huh?
Excuse me?
Idea? No idea who that was.
I know who did it.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh. You want to reveal that tonight?
No. Right.
Tried.
Not.
All right. I tried. Viewer question again. We got another one. Why did you not make it a bigger deal to reveal corruption in Hawaii while you ran one of the biggest news stations on the island?
Okay. How about taking out Chief Kealoha? How about taking out the Kealohas? That was our case completely. Okay. And you tell me something greater than that. Let me tell you the phone calls that I got on that when we were the only ones on the story for nearly 6 months. The Star Advertiser wouldn't even touch it. If you listen to the phone calls that I got, it was pretty much, bro, you better be right. Because if you're not right, bro, it's done. You're over. Okay? So, tell me something bigger than that. And we did a lot of other investigative stuff that was big. Could we make this? Look, we're a media outlet. I said earlier on this phone, my lens of this community and the things that we saw and the sense of responsibility out of love that I had was magnified because I had that lens. I had that intel, but I had no real authority. We took it as far as we could. My editorials that I did oftentimes were to call were to call it like it was. And
that is true. Yeah. Okay. That is true.
So, yeah. You know, I wish we could, as a TV, make this a great place. But meanwhile, I have a lot of confidence in Susan Ballard, Chief Ballard, and her leadership and what she's trying to get done. That police department was in need of a lot.
What is your take on the whole police reform, defund police, the whole...
I think defunding police is a bad idea, okay? It's a bad idea. We don't need to do that here. I actually, even though I got the Schopo endorsement, I'm in odds with them in a way, because it wasn't so much Senate Bill 285 that just got passed, but I was going back to my arguments with Kealoha before we started exposing this corruption as a broadcaster. We wanted more transparency from the police department. It was really tough. They wouldn't even hold a press conference. You could never find out anything. And I was in that place where I found ourselves arguing. In fact, over a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, Chief Ballard asked me to conduct a seminar at the Hilton Hawaiian Village where all the police department and the union on how to develop better relationships with, we only want to say that they got asked to speak with the media. We talked a lot about transparency in this day and age. So look, we're understaffed right now. We have 300 vacancies in the police department. We need more police officers.
Yeah.
We're under-resourced. These guys don't make anywhere near, you know, some of them doing okay now, a lot of overtime, but that's not really, they're doing it out of necessity. But we need to take care of our police department.
Do you feel better mental health training or better social training is needed for these guys?
I think the first police department will tell you, because I've had some really interesting conversations. They know they're not perfect, and not every cop is a great cop, and they take care of their own, and people have been fired, and people have been disciplined or whatever, and that's an ongoing thing to try to make it better and better. And I know that in some places it's got, I don't want to be Pollyannish about this at all, but I do think it's about leadership. I think we're overcoming almost a decade of a lot of stuff that was tolerated, and it takes a while to change a culture. And I do think, look at this, look what's happened about this whole police issue in the middle of COVID. I mean, George Floyd gets killed and it triggers something. Look, I lived through the 60s and the civil rights movements. This is unbelievable. I mean, as tough as that was. And so I understand what's in the forefront, but honestly, we need people to protect people. I can tell you this, people, I mentioned it earlier about the homeless and people don't feel safe. Feeling safe is absolutely job one for people where they live. People will leave if they don't feel safe.
Yep.
And we have to rely on our police officers to do that. Okay. Yep. All the research we used to do in news about family safe all the time, big driver why people look at news. People want to feel safe. It's so important in our basic psyches. All right.
We're going to agree. Couldn't agree more. Another real question. You have the opportunity, and we're going to go light here in this one.
Yeah.
You have the opportunity in this forum to share with future constituents in their 20s and 30s about yourself, and many say they don't know much about you except you ran Hawaii's News Now successfully. Aside from being a good business person, what should people, persons in that demographic, know about you and connect with you on?
Okay. Well, thank you.
Nice question.
I don't usually talk about myself very often. I mean, and so this whole thing is, all right. So I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. My mother was the youngest of nine. My father was the oldest of seven. I grew up in a bilingual household. I was the first in my family to go to college. I was all set to go to Boston College when my dad got transferred to Pearl Harbor. He was a machinist because they were closing down. Robert McNamara was Secretary of Defense under Lyndon Johnson. And when John Kennedy was assassinated, Johnson became president. They did some stuff to Massachusetts, especially because Kennedy was not unlike Senator Inouye. He took care of his home state. So my father was working at a place called the Watertown Arsenal Civil Service, and they were closing that. But they offered a transfer to one or two places, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, or Newport News, Virginia. My mother was a driving force in my life, wanted to come to Hawaii, but not without me, the oldest son. So my whole life changed when I was 18 years old, and that was back in 1965, because my mother had an eighth grade education, okay? My father was a guy who was the oldest of an immigrant family, shining shoes, during the Great Depression at the age of 7 and 18 in 1941, joins the war, joins the Navy and goes to war. I mean, I came from that kind of stock. And
right.
So for me to go to college was a big deal, and I came out here. And then I went to college, I came out here, and did half my undergraduate UH, and then my mother got very sick, and I went back east to take care of her. So I ended up playing ball at small school, Springfield College. And after graduating, I started coaching football at the University of Connecticut. That's what I wanted to do. And then because I had a good playing experience here, Coach Price, Larry Price, asked me to come back and coach with him. And I did, went back and went to graduate school.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Time's Over. Time's over. No sleeping tonight.